I'm Jeannie Allen, and this is Reality Check. If you'd like a free subscription to the podcast so you never miss a program, please sign up at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. Hi, and welcome to another edition of Reality Check. I'm Jeannie Allen. I'm so pleased today to have on my show as my guest, Andy Rosen, the chairman and CEO of Kaplan Incorporated. Kaplan serves more than 1 million students worldwide, 13,000 employees, oh my gosh, has operations in 30 plus countries, and has been transforming student lives in lots of ways that we're going to talk about in just a couple of moments. Andy's embraced an outcomes-based approach to education, focusing on student achievement and success at all times, and has been at the forefront of a burgeoning online education market, which is increasingly going global. He's got a fantastic background. I won't tell you all of it. You can get it in a link to our website, as you know, at edreform.com. But he oversaw the development of the first fully online law school and began his career as a lawyer. And he told Newsweek at one point he felt like he was always battling with other people, what his desire was to work in tandem with others to build things. Andy, did you really say that? And welcome.
I'm not sure where you got that from, Jeannie, but thank you for having me. And it does sound like something I would say, because it's a lot more fun to create than to just battle over the spoils.
Well, I think a lot of people feel like they're constantly battling in education to get the best programs for kids possible. So I really appreciate your coming on to talk about a lot of things. And one that I would just love to jump into first and foremost is that you oversaw the transfer of Kaplan's online university to Purdue University in Indiana, which has become known as Purdue University Global, an extension of the system designed to serve working adults. It's fascinating development, and I'd love to hear, how did this groundbreaking transaction actually occur, and why?
Well, you really have to understand Purdue Global, you kind of have to think about the two institutions that that came together. Start with Purdue, and Purdue's a very unusual institution. It's one of those schools that for a long time, and certainly since Mitch Daniels became its president, tends to focus regularly on what is the reason it's on this earth? Like, why did it get created? And Purdue was a land-grant institution, still is a land-grant institution, but the land-grant institutions in the mid-1800s were created for the express purpose of providing access to people who previously hadn't had the ability to go to university, you know, which at that time was, you know, limited to the, to private school kids from the Northeast. So there are a lot of schools that came out of the Land-Grant Act that have become elite institutions. And there are a number of schools that have become access institutions. But Purdue, I think, better than anybody else, sort of balanced the two and became an elite institution with a real focus on access. Mm-hmm. So you see that sort of that feeling of access in a number of things that that Purdue has done just since Mitch Daniels became president. So, for example, one of the first things Mitch did was freeze tuition. So since 2012, Purdue has not had a tuition increase. And, in fact, it costs less to go to Purdue today than it did in, you know, 7 years ago.
Isn't that amazing?
Which is maybe the only major university in the country that's true. I mean, in fact, I'd be shocked if there was another university even close to that. Purdue has been focused on the income share agreements in which students, instead of taking on student debt, agree to pay a portion of their income for their first few years out of college, which is a really interesting dynamic that's similar to how schools or students get their education funded in some other countries.
Right.
And they've also been very focused on, like, the free speech movement. You know, you don't find the sort of the banning of speakers and so on at Purdue, because they are, it's an institution that's very focused on really helping their students understand what it is to hear alternative viewpoints and how they should handle that in ways that go that don't include stopping the speech. So I guess the point is that they really focus on the kinds of things that matter to, if you want to be attractive to students broadly. And in this case, Purdue for the last several years have been thinking about how do we extend further into online, which creates further access, and how do we serve what President Daniels has called the 21st century land grant mission, which is serving working adults who, you know, may have missed that first opportunity to go to college, or may have gone to college for a couple of years, got an associate's degree, but haven't gotten a bachelor's, but are now in their careers and need more. And so Purdue was thinking about that issue very carefully. And if you set that aside for a moment, you've got Kaplan University. Mm-hmm. And Kaplan University is a part of Kaplan. We have a number of other parts of Kaplan. But at Kaplan University, we were really thinking about the future of higher education. Everybody talks about it, but we're thinking about it in the context of an institution. And we take very seriously the predictions of people like Clay Christensen and others who say over the next 10 or 15 years, as many as a half of today's institutions could be out of business, mm-hmm. or functionally, you know, bankrupt. And, you know, I kind of think that over the next, you know, whether it's the next 15 years or the next 30 years, it's possible that's an underestimate.
Right.
The market is, that things are shifting so much. And so at Kaplan University, we were thinking, how do we think of our institution in that context? And, you know, we could feel like, well, we're going to be one of the ones who survives. And I think there's a lot of arguments as to why we felt confident that would be the case. We had great results for our students. Our price was affordable. We had a culture that was nimble and so on. But we were kind of thinking, if we could work in concert with a more established brand, that would help ensure the long-term future of an institution that we felt very proud of. And
right.
So we ended up in conversations with Purdue, which is trying to extend into online education and serve adults. We were thinking about how can we bring what we think we do very well to an organization that can assure its future over the long term. And that combination was turned out to be, we think, a very powerful one.
Let me stop you there for a minute, because just such a fascinating history, and I want to come back to what's happening with it. But one of the questions that is constantly on people's minds who don't have experience with online education is, how the heck does it work, right? How is that possible that this works for kids? And I was in a... I've seen it before. I've been in conversations with people. I participated in an online degree program, or one that was partially online. And it just felt like I actually got more interaction with students and professors than less. So talk a little bit about that, because I think folks think, well, you're just sitting in front of a computer. And that's not really the case, right, Andy?
No, not at all. I mean, I think people who are suspicious or skeptical about how online education can work really have not experienced it. If you spend a little time, and you know, first of all, you can start with just spending time with your children or grandchildren or whatever, you know, whatever, some young people, about how they live their lives and how much, you know, can you have a friendship that exists primarily online? Well, you'd talk to your kids and you'd say, yeah. I mean, a large percentage of their interactions with their friends are online, and they seem to, you know, they get, you know, humor and sympathy and, you know, support and anger all takes place online. And similarly, education, you can build a very supportive environment, a very rigorous, high-quality environment online, in which students get even more interaction with one another than they do face-to-face, because... For example, a professor can ask a question of the class and expect everyone to answer it, not just the one person that they happen to call on in
right.
a traditional face-to-face class. So you actually have to be more on your feet, more alert in an online class, properly delivered, than you do in face-to-face. And I think that all the studies show that online education is, from a results perspective, at least the equal of face-to-face. And I think everybody understands that going forward, online is only going to become more powerful, more rich, and more effective as an educational medium.
And you have to be more efficient too, I would imagine. So going back to Purdue Global, you took your tools and mechanics, if you will, and applied them to Purdue programs. Is that how that works?
Well, with Purdue Global, what we did is at the outset, we literally took the entire student body of Kaplan University and transferred them over to the new institution, Purdue Global. Similarly, the faculty on one day of Kaplan University became the faculty of Purdue Global the next. We said internally that people went to sleep in their purple pajamas, that's the color of Kaplan, and woke up in black and gold. And
And they have a football team now, too.
That's right. We've become big Purdue football fans.
Exactly.
Over time, we expect to add programs that Purdue excels in. I mean, particularly engineering, computer science, and the programs that Purdue is most well known for.
That's fantastic. And so, the focus is on adults, right? But
correct.
Could anyone take these courses?
Sure.
Okay. So it helps adults that haven't finished, as you said, or they had, a blip on the screen in the process of getting their education, or they wanted to go back, which, by the way, what an extraordinary thing. The fact that there's 80 million adults who don't have any post-secondary credential of any kind, and so many jobs require certain skills that can only be developed or obtained through that. It's just extraordinary. So it's one of those amazing efforts that you've undertaken. So thank you and congratulations. But how do you reach them? How do you help people be convinced of that and understand the potential?
Well, I think that I think it's hard to be an adult in the job market today and not understand that there's increasingly a demand for higher education. I mean, we're increasingly an information economy. The jobs that don't require education are getting automated and are going away. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, the jobs that will exist over the course of the 21st century are those that that require the kind of judgment, creativity, problem-solving skills, the ability to work with others that a good university education provides. And so I think it's kind of the rare person who doesn't have a degree right now who never has thought about whether they ought to get a degree in order to move ahead in their careers, because they're seeing it every day. So there's a lot of openness to getting further education from that 80 million, that population of 80 million.
And what do you see from the K-12 system, Andy, as the products, obviously, of the K-12 system is who you all serve? What do you see as some of the hope and hopeful signs, as well as some of the challenges as you guys develop? I mean, I think that it's been very, very hard for many institutions of higher education over the years, many that have to offer remedial education as opposed to being able to have, a core freshman year, or that find themselves dealing with a lot of transients. What do you see that we should know about?
Yeah, it's when you get into discussions with people from both K-12 and higher ed, they tend to point fingers at one another and say, this whole problem, the whole problem is your fault. Mm-hmm. That is, in K-12, they say, we're not getting the kind of, teachers out of this system that the higher education system ought to be delivering. And then, of course, the higher ed institutions say that the students come to school not ready to compete at the college level. And I think that it bespeaks a problem that exists. It definitely exists in higher ed, but I think it exists throughout our system, that our K-12 system is not always built around producing kinds of people who can be successful in college, just as our college system does not necessarily see its job as producing the kinds of people who can be successful in the workplace. Mm-hmm. There's kind of these, if you think of it as a kind of set of pipes, these pipes are not connected.
Right.
What comes out of one is not flowing directly into the next. And that is a real issue. I mean, people, those states that have become more effective at trying to build an effective entryway into higher ed from the K-12 system and from their higher ed system into the workplace, those states are going to be more successful over time.
And so siloed, as we've talked about, right? And the notion more and more that we're hearing is, let's think about what those ultimate career goals may be. And not every institution is going to serve everyone, but then let's back map what a child as early as second or third grade needs. I mean, I'm still struck by my friend Kelly Young from Education Reimagined, who informed and educated me that the reason we teach biology, chemistry, and physics in that order in high school is alphabet. It has nothing to do with science, right? And so maybe the student aspiring to go into a scientific field or someone who's just not sure needs the well-rounded or a particular order, but they'll never know what it is until sometimes it's too late or they have to kind of start over.
Well, I think that, just as I mentioned earlier, that I think Purdue has done a really good job of constantly grounding itself on what are the purposes of this institution? Why are we here? You know, that's sort of required of the entire educational system. Why are we here? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you start asking those fundamental questions, it's very straightforward. I mean, we know that we want to give kids a set of skills and capabilities that they can make them successful in their lives. We want to give them the ability to imagine a world that can be better. That we want to give them the citizenship skills and the critical thinking skills and so on. Like, it wouldn't take, you know, you could take people from all over the map, and if you just gave them the task of figuring out what the goals of our education system should be, it wouldn't be that hard. What's hard, for some reason, is contorting what we have back towards those guiding goals.
Right, exactly. And I love the question, you know, why are we here? And, you know, I think that there are a number of moves out there afoot to try to address that. Do you see any other promising innovations or changes on the horizon that can help us address that?
Well, I mean, I think that there are... there are definitely some, you know, and you're in this conversation, you're by far the K-12 expert, so I'm going to focus on higher ed. There are some institutions that I think have done a really good job at it. I mentioned Purdue, but I think Arizona State is a really good example of an institution mm-hmm. where under Michael Crow, they have persistently asked the question, why does the state of Arizona want us here? And how can we serve the state and ultimately the country? And I know that they would say the world over time. And as a result, they've made a lot of changes that are, that are sort of abnormal from a higher education standpoint, but actually are quite consistent with the underlying goals of a public university. But it doesn't have to be a public university. I think that Dan Porterfield, who was until just... a few weeks ago was the president of Franklin and Marshall College, a small liberal arts school in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. was doing some of the same things in terms of really turning that school into one that is welcoming to all kinds of students and all kinds of aspirations. And he just left to become to run the Aspen Institute, but I'm hoping he'll find his way back into another university at some point. But I think there are institutions that are doing this really well. But it's sometimes disappointing to say you can name them all, the
right.
ones that are doing it well.
Right. Well, I had Chris Whittle on the show, and he had a great comment about, he said, I'm fond of this quote, it takes a tremendous amount of launch velocity to get through the gravity field. And,
right.
he was referring more to his world of K-12, but I think the same could apply to education. The higher ed, the gravity field is incredible. How much does policy have to do with it, Andy? I know it's a double-edged sword in a lot of ways. You know, Washington has not played a huge role in higher ed, but are there things that Washington can and should do to enable innovations in higher ed?
Yeah, so there definitely are policy issues, but I think that particularly in higher ed, there's sort of a set of incentives or powers that impact things. So things like tradition and prestige and scarcity sit right alongside things like regulation and accreditation and funding mechanisms to push the whole system towards kind of a backward-looking approach that, you know, how can we look more like everyone else instead of try to look different from others? So, you know, even if you had policies that were meant to encourage innovation, you still would have this very strong pull within higher ed to try to only attract the best students and not be open to others, to be prestigious, to and to follow the kind of the traditions of higher ed. So, you know, even when things like, you know, now we in this country we think of online education as being fairly acceptable. I mean, not by everybody, but more and more. But when we at Kaplan started an online institution back in the 1990s, I mean, we were subject to withering criticism. It was not just us, University of Phoenix at the same time, just pounding that, you know, online education cannot be real.
Right.
Because there's something about the American higher ed in which people seem to think that we achieve perfection at some point. And therefore, by definition, any variation from that perfection is worse. And once you start convincing yourself of that, then it's really hard to try to introduce changes. And yet, you know, in the rest of our economy, you know, I was reading an article recently about, you know, this new Google Assistant that can place a salon reservation, you know, a hair salon reservation.
Yes,
I don't know if you saw that.
It did.
People freaked out about it. How cool is this? And you have to think, it's not because it's so hard to place a salon reservation, I don't think.
No.
You know me.
It's just time. It's time.
Right. But people understood, right, that is evidence. If you can today place a salon reservation without the person on the other end knowing it's a computer speaking to you, what can you do in 5 years or 10 years, right? That's not how a higher ed thinks about innovation. It'll look at an innovation in its first day, declare it wanting, and reject it.
Right. So,
you know, it's just a different kind of environment than you find in much of the rest of our economy.
Well, and I think the opportunity to give access to education to people who, as you said earlier, like the original land grants, who don't have access or the ability right now to go somewhere on ground, who may have been, frankly, frustrated or intimidated by the process, let's be honest. Lots of people who don't complete went through that, who for whatever reason don't want to be in a room with a bunch of folks being talked down to or at. By the way, it was awesome for me. I sat in lecture halls. I listened. It was something that at the time, at the place, it worked for me. It doesn't work for everyone, but we should still have everyone be able to access as much higher learning as possible. And so when I think about my experience, as I said at the top of the show, myself in courses, delivering courses through our Ed Reform University that we had at one point in time, listening to friends that I know who've gone back to school, they feel like they're immediately plugged in and connected to a group of people they'd never have met before. And I think the idea of being able to meet people all over the country, let alone world, who are in your same experience is nothing but a plus for our country.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, I mentioned earlier these predictions that, you know, a lot of institutions are going to go out of business. And I think that regardless of what you know, what one thinks about the, you know, sort of the ratio of those who survive and those who don't, it is definitely the case that there's going to be a lot of pressure on the higher ed system in years ahead, and in particular on individual institutions, because some institutions are going to grow, they're going to be more successful and take a larger percentage of the of the students who are graduating from high school. And others are going to get squeezed out. And I think that, you know, one thing that you have in higher ed that is much less so in K-12 is you do have choice. And so if an institution can, come up with a value proposition for students that is superior to others, students, the funding system permits students to take their dollars and go to those places that that have that higher value proposition. And I think you see, you know, again, I mentioned, Arizona State. I think that they view themselves as, you know, investing in a better value proposition for students. And I think that Purdue feels the same way. And I think there will be a few others that will probably be much bigger. And so if you're in other institutions, you should be thinking about what your distinctive value proposition is, because just looking like the institution alongside you is not going to be enough, because you could both come to an end. And one of the things that we at Kaplan are very focused on is how can we help institutions be successful? And, mm-hmm. you know, with Purdue, we named it Purdue Global for a reason. We collectively named it Purdue Global because we talk about this as an American phenomenon, but the same dynamics that enable a student, you know, growing up in, you know, in D.C. or in, Indiana to assess, to have a choice among all the institutions in the country, they actually have a choice between all the institutions in the world mm-hmm. in terms of where they want to go to school. And the same is true of students around the world. And so, you know, as we sit here today, America has the opportunity to build one of our greatest export products in terms of, you know, in the sense of education.
That's right.
You know, a school like Purdue can be a global university. Other institutions can become global institutions if they're willing to do what it takes to become attractive to students from around the world. And, you know, we feel like at Kaplan we're well positioned on this because I think it's probably the case that we bring more students into the United States to study across our various programs than anybody else, mm-hmm. But also more students into the UK, Australia, Singapore, and other places that we're where we have a big presence. And so we're a big part of the international flow of students, and I think a lot of that is bringing students to our partners in various countries. And so, you know, we work with a lot of universities and continue to add universities that want to get the benefit of being part of the international education marketplace, not just their local ones.
It's really extraordinary. The extraordinary opportunities that, you know, have developed just in a couple of short decades, if you think about it. It really is amazing. Andy Rosen, let me ask you a final question about one of the kind of core businesses of Kaplan, I think it was at least, the SAT prep. That's how a lot of people know Kaplan. And SAT has undergone some challenges, right, over the last several years. People question its credibility. It went through recentering. It went through taking out those pesky vocabulary terms and antonyms to synonyms and all those things. And yet most of us, even though it's painful for us, it was painful for our kids, we saw that as an important value to help gauge whether or not you were able at least to place into a school and profit from the school. Is that just not the case anymore?
Well, you know, look, schools, universities are always going to have to figure out a way to compare apples to apples. You know, students are... they're looking for a common yardstick, because you get a B in one school and then, a B in another school on a different course. And, you know, what does that mean? And those are, when you think about the number of high schools that exist in the United States and obviously around the world as well, how do you sort of benchmark all of those? And the SAT has, since the 1940s, served as one of the primary mechanisms by which universities are able to do that. And I think that there's going to be common yardsticks for a long time to come, you know, whether it's the SAT, the ACT, or, mm-hmm. you know, or some other vehicle, because it's universities need that. They have to be able to figure out a way to, to determine how to compare one student versus another. And it is just, you know, it is one of the tools that they use to do that. The SAT has some predictive quality when it comes to, you know, predicting first-year student success. I don't think the College Board claims that it can predict everything. But I don't think you're going to see the SAT or ACT go away. I think that they're part of the long-term future. They are always under siege, in part because we don't like the notion of scarcity. You know, if you really want to get into Penn and you don't get in, it's very frustrating. And I think these college admission tests sometimes become the reason, but they're not the reason. The reason is that Penn can only take so many students.
Right.
You know, it's Rutgers can only take so many students. It's not, the schools will always have to have some vehicle for making the distinctions.
To measure it, because Ms. Smith may give me a B and you an A, and maybe I deserve the A, right? Because there is subjectivity.
In that example, you probably
in
did.
In our classrooms. Andy, thank you so much. As always, been a pleasure talking to you. I also want to make sure that I remind people, we have been doing so in all the podcasts for this fall, that you, among other people, are going to be one of our honored guests and speakers at CER's 25th Anniversary Silver Summit in Miami, Florida, October 25th and 26th, and you'll be talking about new university ideas and innovations. So for anybody who wants to meet Andy Rosen, Kaplan, and lots of other innovators up close and personal, please come on down to Miami. You can find out more information there. And Andy's bio and more information about Kaplan and Purdue Global are online at CER's website, edreform.com. Andy, thank you so much. I am so grateful to have had you as my guest this week on Reality Check.
Well, thanks, Jeannie. Congratulations on the 25th anniversary. I mean, this is an organization you founded, you've led for almost all of its 25 years. It is really a remarkable story, and it's done a lot of good work. So congratulations to you.
Thank you so much. It's sometimes hard to believe, but grateful that it's put me in touch with people like you over the years. Thanks again.
Thanks, Jeannie.
Reality Check is a weekly podcast produced by National Review and posted on Monday at nationalreview.com. If you like what you heard in this podcast, and I hope you did, you might want to subscribe for free and make sure you don't miss any future programs. You can subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And you can also find much more about education reform, opportunity, and innovation at the Center for Education Reform's website, edreform.com. Don't forget, tune in to Reality Check every week.